Well, good morning, folks. I'd like to welcome you to this early session here of on Saturday of the Sun Symposium. For those who might still be half awake, this is session 121 of the paper on Seamus Heaney and the Black Goddess, Everything Mormon Feminists Never Thought to Ask. The paper is being delivered by Karen Marguerite Maloney. Karen, who is right here, this lovely lady here, has a BA and an MA degree in English from BYU and has a PhD in English that she received from UCLA. She has published poetry and essays in Dialogue, Sunstone, BYU Studies, and Exponent 2, and is author of a forthcoming article on Seamus Heaney in the 20th Century Literature. She's currently a lecturer at UCLA in the UCLA Writing Programs and a Sunstone correspondent, which is a fine group of people. The comments will be offered by Bonnie Lynn Mitchell. Bonnie is a fifth-generation Mormon. Indicates here she attended seminary and throughout high school in Southern California and also served a mission in Southern Chile and has three earned degrees from BYU. And while at BYU, managed to become a feminist and a moderate Democrat at BYU, which is something of itself. She then worked for the Utah Navajo Development Council for 3 years and then was director of the Southern Utah University Multicultural Center for 4 years. She's a single mother of two and presently a doctoral candidate in sociology at the University of Texas in Austin, with her areas of specialization in race, ethnic relations, religion, gender, and complex organizations. So we'll now turn the time over to Karen.
Okay, I'll direct your attention to the right spots on the handouts as we get there in the talk. Seamus Heaney and the Black Goddess, Everything Mormon Feminists Never Thought to Ask. Alwyn and Brinley Reese note that a union between the king and the goddess of the land was an essential part of the royal ritual in ancient civilizations of the Near East, while Prontius McKenna points to an even earlier precedent for the persistent tradition, claiming the notion of a mystical or symbolic union between the king and his kingdom is older than Indo-European society. McKenna then continues, linking this ancient idea to the concept of sovereignty. And when the kingdom was conceived anthropomorphically as a goddess, the latter then symbolized not merely the soil and substance of its territory, but also the spiritual and legal dominion which the king exercised over it, in other words, his sovereignty. Let me begin then today by sharing an old Irish legend, one of many that explore the relationship between early Irish kings and the goddess of sovereignty, a powerful, multifaceted figure personifying kingdom, political dominion, Ireland, the earth, feminine principle. The story, that of Neil of the Nine Hostages, demonstrates dramatically how 4 out of 5 men would rather die from thirst, literally, than kiss an ugly old woman. While on a hunting expedition, the 5 sons of the Irish king Eacid stopped to eat some of the game they had killed. However, the brothers had nothing with them to drink, and shortly after the meal began to suffer from overpowering thirst. So one by one, the 4 elder brothers set out to find water. In turn, each of their searches led finally to a well, but its access was guarded by a repugnantly old woman of unlikely proportions. One by one, each brother drew closer to the hag and requested permission to retrieve some water. To each in turn, the hag gave her consent, attaching, however, one condition, a kiss on her cheek. One by one, the young men refused. Finally, Neil, the half-brother and the youngest of the 5, set out to search for water. At length, he encountered the same hag and the same well as had his brothers. But this time, when the hag stipulated the price for the water, Neil breaks the pattern by responding, "For by giving thee a kiss, I will even hug thee." Neil's own mother, after all, had been kept by the queen, his father's wife, in a condition of great hardship, forced to draw water for all of Tara. So reminded likely of his mother's sad servitude, Neil, bending, both embraces the hag and gives her the longed-for kiss, and in some tellings of the story consents also to lie with her. Immediately, the crone is transformed into the fairest of maidens, announces that she is royal rule, and promises the kingdom of Ireland to Neil and his posterity. In this form, the tale serves most obviously as a piece of blatant propaganda in favor of the political ambition of the U Neil dynasty, who were descended from Neil. Nevertheless, as Jean Marcel points out, when Neil kisses the old woman, he is undergoing a kind of sexual initiation in which the mother figure opens a new world to him. The change from an ugly hag into a radiant beauty is really a change in Neil, who is seeing her through new eyes. If ugliness is at least partially a matter of misperception, the ugliness of women a projection of ignorance and fear, then those like Neil, who can visualize beauty where most see none, who can respond to loathsomeness as most respond only to conventional beauty, are unusually gifted individuals, representatives perhaps even of the taboo-defying new man of whom the myths dream. The imagination of the contemporary Irish poet Seamus Heaney is never more daring, and his obeisance to the archetypal feminine principle never more overt than in those poems in which he most closely reenacts Neil's kindness to the hideous Garden of the Well. Indeed, such poems represent Heaney's adaptation of the motif from which the tale of Neil of the Nine Hostages ultimately derives, the ancient wedding union between king and goddess. Heaney may have achieved poetic prominence in a postmodernist age, and his concerns may be painfully relevant to the lives of contemporary readers, but his poetry nevertheless draws much of its power from an ancient Celtic past. When he writes of his betrothal 30 years earlier to green, wet corners, flooded wastes, soft, rushy bottoms, any place with the invitation of watery ground and tundra vegetation, he signals that from boyhood his has been a tender, husbandly relationship with the earth. He also reveals his link to a long line of Celtic predecessors who pledged themselves to the Divine Mother. As a contemporary bridegroom to the goddess, Heaney enacts the modern equivalent of an ancient rite, specifically the Fesh of Tara, or wedding feast of kingship, and his verse embodies conscientious tribute to his sovereign bride. Such tribute is particularly evident in a number of haunting poems at the heart of Heaney's third volume of verse. Uniquely compelling, the poems were inspired by the vivid photographs in the English translation of P.V. Glob's The Bog People, a fascinating study of the numerous discoveries, in Danish peat bogs in particular, of the mummified remains of Iron Age men and women. Several examples of these mummified remains are shown on the handout that I passed out. If you've come in late, there's a pile of them sitting here. The poems are commonly referred to as Heaney's bog body poems, and at least one of them, Come to the Bower, is a genuine love poem to a body recovered from the black maw of the peat. A close reading of the text, as immensely rewarding as it would be, is not my subject today. What I want to explore with you is the deep resonance of the poem's subject matter, particularly its mythological roots. Doing so will accomplish two things. First, it will help to explain the magnetism of Heaney's bog poems, and second, it will suggest a model of behavior for Mormon feminists they may previously have overlooked. After all, how many of us would think to ask a male, Northern Irish, Catholic poet for an antidote to patriarchal sterility? Let me now read the full text of the poem. Come to the Bower. My hands come, touched by sweet briar and tangled vetch, foraging past the burst gizzards of coin hoards to where the dark-bowered queen, whom I unpin, is waiting. Out of the black maw of the peat, sharpened willow withdraws gently. I unwrap skins and see the pot of the skull, the damp tuck of each curl, reddish as a fox's brush, a mark of a gorget in the flesh of her throat, and spring water starts to rise around her. I reach past the riverbed's washed dream of gold to the bullion of her Venus bone. This queen, we know, is literally an ancient mummified corpse, preserved for centuries by the unique tanning properties of bog water acids. The poem itself is a record of the contemporary, exciting discovery of such a body, lying and as has lain indefinitely beneath layers of turf. What is remarkable here is that the experience is described from the viewpoint of a narrator carefully, gently approaching the body of his lover, preparing literally to make love to a body long dead, but as seen through the eyes of this narrator, nonetheless inviting. In Come to the Bower, the woman to whom the narrator responds is the earth goddess as loathsome hag, and her bedchamber is, in this case, her grave. Anyone who has seen the photographs in P.V. Glob's The Bog People would never mistake the incredibly preserved 2,000-year-old corpses of the women from Boar Fen, the decapitated girl from Room, or the Windaby girl, all on display on the top half of the handout, no matter how attractive they may have been in life for conventionally beautiful women. Though their uncanny preservation admittedly inspires awe, still, they simply do not look as once they did in life. The bodies are shrunken, wrinkled, leathery brown, partially decomposed, scarcely the stuff of which love poetry is made. And yet, Come to the Bower highlights a loving act of sexual foreplay with just such a 2,000-year-old partner. come to the bower itself does not dwell on the less attractive physical characteristics of the body it describes, what love poem would? Yet we can fairly assume that she shares much in common with the female personae depicted more frankly in others of the bog poems, portraits certainly no less disquieting than Glob's photographs. Indeed, not one of the female bog bodies featured in Heaney's poems can be described as alluring. They add up instead to the opposite extreme, a composite loathly lady every bit as revolting as those in the tradition of Niels Haag. For example, in Punishment, not only is the head of the adulteress shaved to a stubble of black corn, but her brain is exposed, her body shrunken and ridged by muscle and bone. Similarly, in Bog Queen, the speaker recounts interminable years as a slowly decaying victim of the elements. Her stomach and socket were reduced to cavings. Her nails shielded bruised berries, and her breasts, likened to glacial debris, became soft moraines. And in Strange Fruit, the girl's leathery beauty includes a broken nose, dark as a turf clod, eye holes blank as pools in the old workings, and prune stones for teeth. Facial features rendered even more horrible when one realizes they belong to a decapitated head. Thus, when Heaney approaches his lover's bedchamber, eager to caress her, he joins with Neil as he enfolds a gnarled Irish crone in his embrace. But Heaney adds a further dimension to the role of hag-reversing hero. Hideous as mythic hags like Neil's may have been, they were creatures at least still breathing. Heaney's hag, on the other hand, was retired 2,000 years ago to a watery grave. Come to the Bower could be dismissed as an unwelcome, distasteful portrait of a necrophiliac in action, pathological poet making love to a strangely preserved corpse. But to overlook the poem would be to fail to recognize the vast symbolic power of that ancient corpse. Mark Halen asserts that the hideous women with whom the heroes of Celtic literature grapple can only have risen from the world of the dead. And Joseph Campbell explains how mythology's universal mother figure represents, in addition to profound protection and nourishment, the death of everything that dies. And indeed, the advanced years and grotesque ugliness of the hags of Celtic myth and Arthurian romance do serve as reminders that our own youth and beauty are fleeting, that inescapably we are mortal, and therein lies much of their hold upon our imaginations. By fashioning his own loathly lady from a woman already dead, rather than simply frighteningly close to life's end, Heaney has merely translated this symbolism into more obvious terms. In doing so, he not only creates a hag of unsurpassed horror, a hag to beat all other hags, but he also articulates an even more compelling statement about our need to embrace the world of Dionysius, the realm of flux, transience, renewal, fruition, and decay. Death itself may be a natural life process, but so many of us deny the existence of death that we make it all the more frightening and difficult to face. And if we do not deny death, we fear it. We are trapped in the patriarchal world which stresses existence to the exclusion of non-existence, and fail to benefit from the archetypally feminine, in whose realm existence and non-existence, life and death, are one. Death, then, is no longer accepted as one of the inevitable aspects of life, and so death, part of the Dionysian night side of existence, is gradually relegated to the sinister. Rosemary Radford Ruther observes that, in death, all the component parts of matter, energy, that coalesce to make up our individual self are not lost. Rather, they change their form and become food for new beings to arise from our bones. To bury ourselves in steel coffins so that we cannot disintegrate into the earth is to refuse to accept this process of entering back into the matrix of renewed life. Such a manner of burial represents a fundamental refusal to accept earth as our home and the plants and animals of earth as our kindred. It is not a steel coffin, of course, that has retarded the disintegration of the bog bodies. Their preservation can never be attributed to an unwillingness on the part of Iron Age man to regard death in a realistic manner. Widespread rejection of Dionysian values is a contemporary disorder. But for Heaney to embrace a dead body, even if it has yet to enter back into the matrix of renewed life, is to signify his own comfort in that Dionysian realm, his own identification with the larger matrix as a living entity that contains and supports the human species along with every other. It is an effort that flies in the face of the patriarchal desire to control even death. It is a gesture, ultimately, of humility, an acknowledgement that the personal ego is but a recipient and channel of a destiny flowing from a deep, mysterious ground of being which is the source both of terror and revulsion, as well as of the beautiful play of life. Come to the Bower is reverential tribute to the transcendent realm of the archetypally feminine. The poem is also a bow of recognition, a votive candle lit upon the altar, of a figure relatively obscure and, to the uninitiated, undesirable, among goddesses better publicized, both upstart and underdog. As John Matthews and Marion Green explain, figures like Niels Hag or Heaney's Dark Bowered Queen, whom they see comprising a whole gallery of loathly damsels, black hags, and proud ladies, reflect an even older icon, that of the black goddess of wisdom and sovereignty. It is she whose daughters the prune-skinned, tar-black bog women must surely be, and who, like their mother with the mysterious dark face, offer nothing to conventional suitors. In Robert Graves' view, this mysterious deity, known variously as the black goddess, Sophia, or the goddess of wisdom, is a being entirely distinct from her more famous sister, the white goddess. It is, of course, Graves' own widely published The White Goddess, from which, in this century, her fame primarily derives. So far, he offers enigmatically, the black goddess is hardly more than a word of hope, whispered among the few who have served their apprenticeship to the white goddess. Nevertheless, and notwithstanding the fact that her temples in ancient Hierapolis, Jerusalem, and Rome remained small and unthronged, Graves contends that she once ruled alongside Ishtar, or the Muse, or white goddess. The description I quote here may not provide solid definition, but in typical Gravesian fashion intrigues nonetheless. Unlike Vesta, the ideal woman of patriarchal civilization, deified by the Latins, the black goddess has experienced good and evil, love and hate, truth and falsehood in the person of her sister, but chooses what is good. Faithful as Vesta, gay and adventurous as the white goddess, she will lead men back to that sure instinct of love, which he long ago forfeited by intellectual pride. Monica Stew and Barbara Moore go one step further than Graves in suggesting an historic base for the black goddess. For them, the archetype is an archetype because it represents a past reality. Its power over us as internal image is so profound because it was once an experienced fact of the external world. Claiming that the black Madonnas found in Eastern Europe, Spain, France, and Italy recall the real, historic blackness of the early goddesses of Egypt and Africa. Stew and Moore assert that the likenesses represent solid, iconic remains of the ancient time when the religion of the black goddess ruled Africa, and from thence, much of the rest of the world. Supporting an African provenance accounts most logically for the darkness of the goddess's hue. But that fact need not detract from Peter Redgrove's more imaginative suggestion that the deity is black because she is the symbol and gateway to everything we could know in the apparent blackness beyond visible sight, and because she lives in the darkness men have created by their blindness. One explanation certainly need not cancel out the other. The second, however, is by far the more helpful in analyzing the symbolic significance of a figure like Heaney's bog-preserved hag. Indeed, Redgrove's comments seem closely linked to Campbell's view that as the hero progresses in the slow initiation which is life, the form of the goddess undergoes for him a series of transformations. She can never be greater than himself, though she can always promise more than he is yet capable of understanding. She lures, she guides, she bids him burst his fetters. And if he can match her import, the two, the knower and the known, will be released from every limitation. Woman is the guide to the sublime acme of sensuous adventure. By deficient eyes, she is reduced to inferior states. By the evil eye of ignorance, she is spellbound to banality and ugliness. But she is redeemed by the eyes of understanding. Undoubtedly, the figure of the hag or loathly lady personifies ignorance and deficient vision in the beholder. Her later transformation represents equally well the far-reaching effects of far-seeing, genuine love. In addition, and perhaps most intriguingly, it speaks simultaneously of our repulsion toward and our fascination with ugliness, deformity, age, most frighteningly as they exhibit themselves in women. After all, as Barbara G. Walker points out, patriarchal society often views physical ugliness as the worst of sins in a female, overriding all compensatory qualities of virtue, kindness, or intelligence, because these qualities are more or less irrelevant in a sex object. Ugliness is forgivable in men, but not in women. The bog queen, as foul hag then, is an evocative symbol. At once, the personification of the black goddess of wisdom and sovereignty and clouded, misperceiving vision. Not to mention the infertility of blighted soil and the negative aspects of the Jungian mother archetype, implications we won't pursue today. Even so, the form in which these psychic afflictions materialize is that of a female human body, unequivocally physical, unarguably loathsome as well. Utterly the antithesis of inviting, the hag could scarcely be depicted as more outrageously repugnant, revolting, and foul. Kissing her, therefore, embodies a gesture few men would even consider. Yet the narrator of Come to the Bower is revealed in an act of loving sexual foreplay with her, and we are assured that the lovemaking to follow will be exactly that. Serving in no sense as setting for self-gratifying act, this bower will hallow instead the ritual marriage of tribal spokesman, who loves and honors even his bride's most loathsome features and least ingratiating ways, to the emissary of an earth goddess literally as old as the hills, yet endlessly restored to youth through union with her rightful mate. Come to the Bower indeed adapts the motif of the marriage of sovereignty. The bog body the poem celebrates equals hag, equals goddess, equals earth, equals feminine principle, while its courteous narrator typifies the gentle and courageous among us who not only value Dionysian fluctuation, ambiguity, and paradox, but are willing to exchange patriarchal values for submission to the goddess of such an unaccustomed realm. So, when Heaney's narrator makes love to the hag, the poet both perpetuates ancient tradition and embraces non-linear Dionysian flux. But as Mary P. Brown observed of the goddess figure in Heaney's verse, not only does she represent Mother Ireland, Kathleen Na Houlihan, the terrain itself, but she is also a subject people, and by association, the Irish Catholic consciousness, or to co-opt a phrase from Julia Kristeva, that which is marginalized by the patriarchal symbolic order. Heaney's natural sympathy for the marginalized or victim has been noted often enough. Timothy Carney's remark can be taken as representative. It is precisely the figure of the victim which receives most of Heaney's imaginative generosity. Astutely, Carney has linked this compassion to the characterization of the poet himself as one whose natural habitat is the margin. Heaney is a white male, and as such, a member of the patriarchy. But he is also a Catholic among Protestants, an Irishman in an English-speaking world, a poet among turf cutters. I believe that his minority status has gifted him with uncommon compassion for those defined as marginal by the patriarchy, and that this fact accounts for a sensitivity in his writing toward the feminine, uncommon among male writers of this century. Indeed, his adaptation of the motif of the sacred marriage represents for him the deliberate placing of his allegiance on the side of the oppressed. The rape victim he champions in one poem and the bog body hag whom he loves in another represent every despised minority, every marginal group. When he makes love to the hag, he declares affinity for all those who suffer at the behest of hierarchical, patriarchal society and our need to accord them the same liberating dignity that a hero like Neil of the Nine Hostages bestowed with such miraculous effect on his hag. If Heaney refuses to spell out specific political correctives for the excesses of his times, he nevertheless advocates deference and humility before the goddess as his own form of curative tonic. It is a cure whose imaginative roots can be traced directly to the Irish Catholic succoring of his consciousness. Ted Hughes has affirmed that poetic imagination is determined finally by the state of negotiation in a person or in a people between man and his idea of the creator. How things are between man and his idea of the divinity determines everything in his life, the quality and connectedness of every feeling and thought, and the meaning of every action. Heaney's idea of the divinity, at least as it reveals itself in his public statements, may suggest the best explanation of all for certain postures and attitudes central in his verse, and may antecede even his predilection for the margin. Heaney declares in an essay entitled The Poet as a Christian that his own poetic imagination relates to a deity richly feminine, a mother goddess, if you will. After stating that the masculine certitude of the Ten Commandments offers little to the imagination, he explains by way of contrast what does. I think I am a Christian because the Sermon on the Mount satisfies so much in me that pines consciously and unconsciously for appeasement. But I have no doubt that I'm also a pagan, and that every poet is. Yet perhaps the Catholic poet is lucky, because Catholicism managed to preserve part of the old feminine religion in its structure. The Virgin Mary, intercessor, mother of mercy, star of the sea, occupies in the common psychology the place occupied by the muse in the poetic psychology. To call upon the Father for daily bread and praise the kingdom, the power and the glory, is one thing. There the word acts with all the trustworthiness and rectitude of a breadwinner. But the word is enriched and nurtured when it blesses a woman, and the tongue is deeply humanized when it over and over again it rolls a phrase like, the fruit of thy womb, or when it humbles itself to repeat, pray for us, pray for us, pray for us. For Heaney, Catholicism seems to represent attitudes much more supplicatory than those motivating a Protestant's sturdy negotiation with the boss. The masculine idea of God as a foreman with certain definite views who orders life in shifts of work and leisure is superseded by the sense that there's some kind of feminine intercession to turn to for comfort rather than to haggle with for a raise. In an interview 3 years later, Heaney described further the generally Marian quality of devotion which formed his sensibility. The reality that was addressed was maternal, and the posture was one of supplication. Irish Catholicism until about 10 years ago had this Virgin Mary worship, almost worship. In practice, the shrines, the rosary beads, all the devotions were centered towards a feminine presence, a religion that has a feminine component and a notion of the mother in the transcendental world is better than a religion that just has a father, a man in it. I also, just in my nature and temperament, I suppose, believe in humility and in bowing down and in we rather than I. I hate a moi situation, an egotism, a presumption, a hubris, and I'm using the bowing down to the mother as a way of saying that. So, if we are to take Heaney at his word, his creative consciousness identifies with both the Marian quality of Irish Catholicism and the ancient pagan religion of Northern Europe. The deity to whom he pays homage is most certainly feminine, an imaginative blending of the Virgin Mary and an ancient pagan mother goddess. And for Heaney, bowing down before her in heartfelt supplication remains the only real avenue to grace. Heaney, recall, is a Catholic from the Protestant north of Ireland, at heart a poet profoundly political. I'm convinced, in fact, that the relationship of male lover to female goddess serves as prototype in his verse for the humble, deferential behavior and change of heart needed on both sides to repair the ill effects of English plantation in Ireland and, by extension, centuries of worldwide patriarchal abuse. Indeed, for Heaney, the antidote to the violence, commercialism, and sterility that corrupt contemporary society lies in ritual, spirit-centered, women-focused worldviews that stress the complementary nature of all life forms and focus on social responsibility rather than on privilege. A shorthand way of putting this, renewed faith in the feminine. Specifically, Heaney would praise any existing harmonies between man and the earth, decry the intrusion of the rational, urban, and mechanized when achieved at the expense of the intuitive, agricultural, and natural, and bow in prayer beside the water's edge. By doing so, he invokes the goddess for us all, and with special significance for Latter-day Saints. Like Catholicism, Mormonism espouses a maternal presence, in our case, an actual goddess. The myth Heaney revised of the sacred marriage between king or tribal spokesperson and the goddess of sovereignty should carry added meaning for us. We do not live in violence-torn Northern Ireland, but we do live in a society and age characterized by the psychologist Edward Whitmont as a deadlock of scientific materialism, technological destructiveness, religious nihilism, and spiritual impoverishment. And we live within a religious community which traditionally has repressed knowledge of our Mother in Heaven and emphasized patriarchal values often at the expense of those associated with the archetypal feminine. It is my hope today that the deferential lover in Heaney's Come to the Bower may stimulate our own imaginations to consider new ways to relate to our God and to each other, particularly to the victims and the marginal among us. Just as a legendary, loathly lady waited for her rightful king to reveal himself and break her enchantment, so they wait now, men and women alike, for those who can see past their loathly disguise and who will accord them the honor which will bring to us all a new form of freedom.
I My first response to reading this paper was, wow, someone's writing about things I've thought about. So the first comment is that there's not much here that this Mormon feminist hasn't at least thought about, necrophilia being the one exception, although I see that as more an extension of lines of thought that were already in my mind, and perhaps a helpful extreme. Carrying things to the extreme can pose things more clearly. And what I've done as I've read through this paper, millions of things are coming to my mind from experiences with women's spirituality groups and my own rather unique interpretation of the scriptures. And so I thought I would just pick out a few of the things that have come to my mind as I was reading this paper and share those and hopefully leave time for you to ask questions or comment. First of all, I've been thinking lately about this union between king and goddess in the context of the Adam and Eve story. And I really see Adam as king and Eve as goddess. Adam, of course, in our patriarchal tradition is most often referred to as sort of a reigning patriarch. But if you look at the text, a title that is given to Eve is the mother of all living. Now, to me, the mother of all living is a title of a goddess, and so I would like to see that in that context. And another very important aspect of this whole paper is that Neil's test is to love the ugly. And it is also a test in order of being able to be physical, sexual, with something that is outwardly, with a woman who is outwardly unattractive. And I couldn't help but juxtaposing this because it seems like a similar test to that faced by the two Lakota men who are privileged with an encounter with white buffalo calf woman. I didn't have time to run check this out, and my memory of the story is a bit vague. But an important piece that remains with me is that this woman is physically very, very beautiful. And the first man is overcome by sexual desire and tries to make love with her and is killed in the process. And it is the second man who sees her for what she is inside and learns the knowledge that she has to impart that is allowed life. And so you have this juxtaposition of sexual out of control leading to death and the spiritual recognition leading to life. So that rather than loving the ugly and seeing the spiritual beauty first and seeing the spiritual beauty first and one of supreme physical beauty is the challenge. I think a similar lesson is taught from these very different perspectives, and that is that the surface appearance is not the most important and that the challenge is to look beneath the surface. And then from my feminist experience, I just can't help but make a few comments on this, that the concentration on outer appearance, especially on impossible standards of physical beauty set by the media, advertising, to make women byproducts, to change themselves into something that they are not, other than what they are, to try to approximate externally imposed and male-defined images of bodily perfection, to try and change ourselves, to make us appear more like this ideal is part of the problem. And I attended a Relief Society retreat in Austin, Texas, shortly before I came here, and one of the workshops was on specific details were given on the perfect female body, what sort of proportions the arms should have and the length and all of this. And the focus was on how to make ourselves into this perfect female body. And if we couldn't do that, then we could use certain techniques to make ourselves appear, you know, sort of optical illusion technique like shoulder pads and all that kind of stuff. I think the challenge, whether in beauty or ugliness, is to see beneath the surface, to value the person inside more than the image. And I think as women, we can stop trying to make ourselves into something that we're not, and that it may be the men who need to change more than we do, and that they might need to see us for what we are. Also, this idea of ugliness as projection of ignorance and fear, of course, that has very real implications, or for me, it reminds me of witch hunts, where witches who are the wise old women are persecuted, burned at the stake. And this, to me, is a real evidence or a real case study of patriarchal panic. It's the ignorance and fear of men who feel threatened by the knowledge and power of wise older women. In the text, Karen mentions a tender husbandly relationship with the earth. I have experienced that still in practice in Celtic and Wiccan rituals today. I don't see that overtly practiced in Mormon rituals, especially in the sort of business orientation, but our scriptures have precedent for that sort of attitude toward the earth, especially in the concept of stewardship. Celtic old religion and this Irish contemporary poet may be able to teach us or give us concrete examples of how to be better, more loving stewards of the earth. Next is the earth as goddess, that concept I love. My area of study is concentrated race and ethnicity, especially on Native Americans, and so there's the concept of Mother Earth. And the ways that one shows respect and love is basically an attitude of gratitude, gratefulness for sacrifices. And one shows this by walking gently on the earth, walking in harmony, walking in balance, walking with respect for all living, two-legged, four-legged, those that crawl, those that fly, respect for elders, respect for ancestors who have gone before. And the scripture that comes to mind there is that the Lord is pleased with everyone except those who refuse to acknowledge his hand in all things, which I equate with is okay with everyone except those who are ungrateful. And I think in our society today we are ungrateful and disrespectful of the earth in most cases. So I was kind of disappointed that we didn't get more application to Mormonism in this paper, so I thought I would add some of that, which is what I'm trying to do. The model of behavior for Mormon feminists, which I think is suggested but not elaborated in the paper, is that for women to recognize who you are inside, your own value, and for men to be respectful, deferential to women as a source of physical life. And I want to mention very briefly an experience I had coming with the earth. I was trying to work on my dissertation, or not working on my dissertation, as been stated last night, sitting out by a beautiful creek in the Austin area. And I looked up, and there was an awful noise that interrupted my reverie, whether dissertation-related or not. And there was a tractor which was tearing at the roots of this beautiful, symmetrical, very balanced, very beautiful tree. And it was just sort of plowing away at the earth, and in the process, ripping roots and ripping pieces of the branches away. And I had never had the feeling that I had at that time, which was rape. And the injustice of destroying this beautiful tree because of an imaginary line that had been drawn. I put myself there, standing on the roots that were left, and in an effort to protect what was left of that tree so that it might continue to live, with the bulldozer just sort of coming right up to me and stopping. I like the careful, gentle approach. That seems to me to be a good model. The lovely lady, the ugliness. Talk about that for just a second. I have many women friends, some of whom I love extremely dearly. And a male friend of mine asked me at one point about a particular woman that I've had a very long-term relationship with. Is she beautiful? Is she pretty? And the question just sort of struck me kind of strangely, and I said, well, to me, she's extremely beautiful. But then to try and explain that is very difficult. And I wanted to make it clear that I'm not talking about the sweet spirit. It's not that. It's a strong spirit that to me is very beautiful. In relationship again to the Mother Earth, the idea of the dead hag, I think we can carry that symbolism to the earth, and the fact that Mother Earth is old, and we've killed parts of her, and we humans threaten to kill all of her with our pollution, with our nuclear weapons. Yet we are called to love her, to have compassion on her current ugliness and scars, to change our lifestyles, to redeem the earth, to quit fighting the chemical and nuclear wars so that we don't destroy what's left, to see beyond the short-term profits, to move Mother Earth from externality, that's a cost that's not figured into the economic equations, to centrality. A million ideas here. I think I'll just take two more. The first one is this notion of female as providing both protection and nourishment and death. This notion of opposed qualities in the female is not just in Irish or Celtic, but it's seen in Near Eastern, Asian, Native American, many mythologies that relate to powerful female have both notions together. And I think we can see it in Eve also. She's called the mother of all living. She also brings death. And the last thing I'll just mention here is, maybe two more. When the earth goddess, as old as the hills, restored to you through union with the rightful mate, to me, images of Inanna come up. Women in control of their sexuality, celebration of that sexuality within sacred context, and the life-giving power that that has. And lastly, I read in the paper that Seamus Heaney's of his inclusion of every despised group, every marginalized group. I questioned every, you know, do I want to concede that his insight and his sympathies would include everyone? That's something I'm kind of sensitive to. Does it really include me? Does it include Native Americans? But I think the case is a good one, because I think for us in our culture, the worst case scenario is the dead body. And so if you look at the dead body as being the most loathsome, the most despised, then every other group would be included in that which is to be valued, honored, respected, and approached with tenderness and love.
Thank you, lovely ladies, for those presentations. Does somebody have the time? Because none of us have a watch up here. 9:15. Okay, we have time for questions.
I think crones are beautiful, and that's part of not changing, not trying to approximate externally imposed standards. Some of the older women, I don't know, I see them as beautiful.
Any other questions or comments? Rebuttals. Do you ladies have anything to add on?
Not at this point.
Not at this point. Well, thank you very much for coming. Remind you that tapes of each session are available immediately right after downstairs on the first floor down there.